Part 3, Father with the Daughters of the Mother. If Swami Prabhavananda seems to have bent over backward in promulgating a monastic life for American women in Vedanta, why not? Who else had taken up such a cause? Swami Vivekananda himself had given holy orders to several women and had outlined his plans and hopes in this regard. In India, political realities and societal conservatism had obstructed and delayed their fulfillment. Swami Abhedananda, in his Western work, had made a start. Swami Paramananda and Swami Siddheshwarananda in France, having ventured boldly to implement Swamiji's ideas, suffered abuse at the hands of their critics. It was left to Swami Prabhavananda to succeed in attracting young women to the life of renunciation in the patterns of Sri Ramakrishna and the Holy Mother, inspiring them to lifelong dedication and, with Herculean struggle, establishing their place in the Ramakrishna movement. It was no small accomplishment. The Swami was a feminist long before the term was coined, and it became fashionable to be one. This chapter should be written not by me, but by them, his nuns. Let us hope one day it will be. Meanwhile, I will report whatever I saw and understood. The Santa Barbara property of Spencer Kellogg in the suburb of Montecito had been in use for several years as a cloister for Swami's recruits, the women and the men alternating in spending periods of time there. In 1947, it became the main province of the nuns, and the first vows were given. With the acquisition of Tribhuvana College, a new pattern emerged. Just as most of the convent members were living permanently at Santa Barbara, most of the would-be monks now lived at Tribhuvana. A smaller selection of each, their talents or requirements suited to the life of the center, remained in Hollywood. Swami had had an ideal relationship with Sister Lolita. I sometimes think it set the example in his mind for what he would like to see all of us realize or experience. I saw Sister on one brief visit that I made just before her passing away. She was impressively indrawn and silent, just like Swami. They had lived together for years, she as his hostess, support, domestic advisor, friend, and student. He told us, "Sister and I lived as close as brother and sister all those years, and never once did we have an argument." It set a standard a bit too high to be realized daily in our life in Hollywood. At mealtime in Hollywood Center, we sat at the long table, which nearly filled the room, women down one side and men down the other, with Swami's place carefully reserved at the head. Everything would depend on the Swami's mood. If he was serious, all was silence. If lighthearted, great repartee could ripple up and down, back and forth. It was more difficult when he was out of station. There could be tension. I had expected to be bothered by the mixing of the sexes in close quarters, but through the grace of God and the Swami, I not only found no difficulty in it, I came to understand and appreciate it. It was clear that he hoped to engender in us all a true spiritual freedom buoyed up by holy company, group which would supply physical food in common and spiritual food for our souls, purified so far as possible of sex and gender consciousness. that it did not at least partially succeed. Overcoming opposition, he obtained permission from headquarters in India to give both the brahmacharya novitiate vows and the sannyasa or final vows to the nuns in ceremonies performed in California. And accordingly, these were given at regular and appropriate intervals. This is still the custom today, while for the monks, sannyasa must be held in India. This means that not only are the brahmacharins and prabrajikas, as the sannyasinis are called, members of the Ramakrishna order, but a few who came to Swami long ago, answering his call to renounce, are among the most senior of the Western members. On his trips to India, he took nuns with him. I recall one incident he reported to us on his return. When they had wished to enter a certain temple in South India, a panda, a guardian priest, seeing the Western faces, had stopped them. He asked Swami Prabhavananda his caste. "Are you a Hindu?" Swami inquired of the priest. "What do you mean," said the other, "asking me a question like that?" "Well, no Hindu ever asks a monk his caste." And with that, they all went into the temple. The feminine contingent in the Hollywood Center was not restricted exclusively to the professed. Swami Prabhavananda also opened his heart and home to a few others whom he believed belonged there or who could profit from the opportunity. Such, in my years, was Ujjala, Ida Ansel, the little lame one Swami Vivekananda had known as baby, the aging mother of one of the senior nuns was another. Ujjala, or baby, was almost sacred to some of us as a last link with the age of Swamiji. Those who had known him were becoming scarce, and here was one who was responsible for giving us the notes of some of his very best lectures. Lively, game, alert, intelligent, and sometimes pathetic, Ujjala added much to the life of the center. Her story has been related elsewhere by those who saw her much more than I did. Now and then I would coax her to a quiet corner and ask her about those historic days. The men at Tribhuku would travel to the Sarada convent not only on special occasions, such as the Durga Puja, but at quieter times also. We had there the privilege of seeing Swami Prabhavananda at his most relaxed. He felt there the sort of freedom one imagines that Holy Mother knew in Jairambati, her native village, leaving behind the strictures of society and demands of the devotees. Santa Barbara was a different world for him. In the first years, he enjoyed the company of a beautiful Great Dane, Rama, who was his pal. One afternoon, while all were sitting in the convent living room, the dog on the floor, a little bird flew in an open window. As it beat about for exit, Rama, alerted with a start, stretched herself toward it with wide open jaws. The poor bird, seeing its danger, flew frantically from ceiling to floor and suddenly hurled itself right into the dog's open mouth. Rama was so surprised she had no time to react, and the birdie was out before the jaws closed. Swami at once deduced the moral. We too plunge often blindly, headlong, into the trap, our very death. Such is the way of Maya. But then there is grace. There were beds and beds of flowers, profuse and gorgeous, as well as those woven in among the rocky paths cut steeply into the hillside, which gave Swami exercise and distant vistas out to the sea. The food, well, the women had learned to utilize their ample talents in preparing Bengali dishes close to those who Swami had known in his own land. There was not, however, any weakening of the traditional monastic ideal. Surrounded as they were by what would seem to be all the good things of this world, the nuns might be reminded by the teacher that Holy Mother had once taught a rather peculiar and difficult prayer, ask to be desireless. Swami once elucidated this with the following comment. Liberation is really beyond our conception. Buddha described it the most logically by negative terms, the complete cessation of suffering and misery. Desirelessness is really not a correct word. Freedom from craving is a better expression, because we may have desire to continue spiritual practices and so on, and these do not prevent liberation. Are they to be done away with? Before the nuns set constantly the ideal life of Holy Mother and the fidelity and devotion of the other women disciples and the Master, Swami was always delighted if one felt inclined to do the formal worship. Many of the women performed it daily, either in their turn at the shrine or in the privacy of their own room. Santa Barbara had an atmosphere heavy with the perfume of devotion and worship. A Vedanta nunnery, being something new in the order, experiments had to be made. It seemed they were forever devising and designing a new habit. Various styles and colors were tried. At one point, Swami may have thought it was becoming obsessive. His comment was terse and pointed. Color your mind with Garawa inside. That's what counts. There were intense disappointments for Swami, both in the monastery and in the convent. Some with whom he had had years of association, or of whom he was particularly fond, drifted away in the course of life's exigencies. We could only guess what he must be silently going through on these occasions. Again, it was the women in whom he had such high hopes and who had needed all the support he could give, over whom he agonized more. These are personal stories and have no place here, but looking back, one can only wonder at the heartache they must have stirred in him and at how he withstood it in cheerful serenity. Swami kept a watchful eye over the nuns and monks when they were together in his presence. So long as he lived, something mysterious was at work, making what he envisaged gel. By and large, he was successful in establishing the mood in which high thought and detachment hold sway and unseemly tendencies are overcome. Even today, I feel that family bond among us, perhaps in his powerful thought force, wrong ideas would not arise. So far as I ever saw, his dealings with everyone were unambiguous and exemplary, a lesson to us all, a ballet choreographed and executed to perfection. Part 4, Dancing to gong and cymbal. To me, with a Quaker background, Vedanta in Hollywood seemed a world awash with worship. In the San Francisco Center, we had learned the theory of Indian ritual as performed in the order, and by general participation, learned also to appreciate the atmosphere of devotion and inwardness which it can generate. But it was Swami Prabhavananda who employed worship as a primary function in his work, and who, by example and instruction, led us to attempt it and to understand its deeper meanings. He made me, I confess, a ritualist. He too had been skeptical as a young monk when Swami Brahmananda had told him, "Be ritualistic." Let the reader not misunderstand. This did not and does not mean being orthodox or punctilious in daily conduct or dictatorial about ritual details. There was an air of freedom, a joy born of spontaneity in the way Swami did the worship and taught others to do it. He made clear that the expression of one's own inner feeling was what was wanted, not slavish adherence to a rule book, gesture, or sequence. The prescribed daily worship of Sri Ramakrishna is carried out in a number of our centers in the West, each adapting it to its own requirements and convenience as to length, the hour of performance, the elaborateness, items to be offered, and so on. In Southern California, it was begun around noon, consumed about an hour and a quarter, and closely approximated the ceremony as offered at Benno Marte in India. It was known as the Dashopacharana, the 10-item worship. More elaborate were the ceremonies, such as the 16-item worship, performed on special occasions. These included the annual birthday celebrations of the Big Four, Master, Mother, Swamiji, and Maharaj, Durga Puja, Kali Puja, Shivaratri, and Homa, the fire ceremony, a relic of ancient Vedic ritual, in which fire is regarded as the deity and receives the offerings. Each had its own detailed format. I was present in the living room when, it must have been as late as 1956, a devotee thought to ask Swami why the traditional birthday of Sri Krishna was not observed and celebrated here in Hollywood. It struck me as curious that this point never seemed to have arisen before. For a moment he appeared to be at a loss, and then he replied, "I guess it's because I am here." Nothing more. And it was, to my knowledge, one of the utterances which were never explained. When Swami presided at the daily worship, he would execute the requirements without losing his mood of absorption. I believe tears rarely came during his worship. If you were present, it seemed the most natural thing in the world just to close your eyes and allow yourself to be caught up in what? An indescribable elevation, a bright fog of abstractedness for which the mystics have scoured their vocabularies, those who have experienced it. But then, to become in this way made one lose sight of that element of theater and elegance which Swami's natural grace imparted to the whole procedure. And so you peeped out now and then, just to be sure you were still on the floor, and to watch the Swami's unselfconscious ballet of God-absorbed devotion. As others learned to make the offerings and the Swami grew older, this scene became less frequent, but we were thus offered an opportunity to experience what he had always said: the ceremony has its own power. Yes, the pujari, the person performing the puja, makes a difference, and to some it will come more naturally than to others, but the puja, or seva, as some prefer to call it, is not a human performance, where he, the Lord, is sought and implored, where one sincerely offers the least of things to him, even without feeling devotion, but merely asking for it. He will manifest himself. He is bound to. And so, with or without Swami, the work of this form of bhakti was accomplished for all. Swami would train the brahmacharinis by putting them in the role of pujari for many of the special pujas, while he became the tantradharak, the prompter. Kali Puja and Shivaratri in Hollywood and Durga Puja in Santa Barbara were real dramas, the former starting in the evening and running on till 4 or 5 in the morning. To see an auditorium full of Western devotees making the best peace they could with a squatting posture, spending a night silently meditating and attending to the exotic motions of a Sanskrit ritual, is to comprehend the conviction of its value infused in these by Swami Prabhupada. Then, when it was finished, he would be the freshest of us all, and this went on for years. Reference has been made earlier to the fact that the worship was actually done in silence, punctuated solely by the ringing of the handbell at prescribed points. So it had been in Northern California, and I therefore supposed that this was the standard practice. When later I experienced in India and other places, Swami Prabhavananda did explain it in detail, not publicly, but in classes for the monastics who were learning it. As a sidelight to discussing the Kali Puja, he once made reference to the following. The Rani Rashmani, founder and proprietor of the Dakshineshwar temples where Ramakrishna lived, constantly referred to herself as the servant of Kali, etc. But this does not mean necessarily that Kali was her ishtam, chosen ideal. In India, it is common for devotees to express devotion to one aspect of the deity outwardly and cherish another aspect in his or her heart. This is because he or she may feel that the chosen ideal is too sacred, too precious to reveal to others. But the said devotee regards all other forms as aspects of one deity, and this also prevents sectarianism. In the Homa ceremony, a novice questioned one day, "Should one offer also one's meditation, japa, and their fruits?" "No, no," Swami replied, "those are already offered." The kitchen was no less the shrine room than the one in the temple, and since the noon meal was prepared in such a way that it would form part of the daily offering, the food had always to be cooked with great care and taste. One good reason for this was the experience Swami had as a brahmachari many years before in Madras. There it was the custom to leave the shrine as soon as the food was offered and wait outside. One of the delicacies offered the Lord in the hot season was cucumber sticks. As the Swami was seated outside doing japa, he thought he heard a voice ask, "Where is the salt for the cucumber?" He thought the heat must have made him doze off and dream, but when he went back in to pick up the food, looking at the tray, he found that sure enough, the salt was missing. Comments on the puja, which Swami offered us in a monastery class in 1950, were taken down in my notebook. As they may not be of the same interest to all readers, they are placed in Appendix B. Part 5, Saturated in Maharaj. We read in the memoirs of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples references to a strong resemblance of Rakhal, Swami Brahmananda, to the Master. Although a physical similarity seems to be intended, I could never understand it, thinking that they did not look at all alike. After years of watching Swami Prabhupada and hearing him speak of his master, some idea of what must be meant has come to me. If it is true that our present body is the result of our many thoughts and habits from past lives, then when in this life one begins to dwell deeply and constantly in thought on a given model, it follows that one can grow into a kind of resemblance of that prototype. Swami was not physically much like Maharaj, and yet his attunement and assimilation into the being of Maharaj was definitely more than merely mental. He was steeped in the thought of his Guru, obsessed with him, possessed of him, merged in him, and everyone knew it. He had become his shadow. Swami did not imitate Maharaj, as many idolizers do their model, nor was he in any sense a clone. Whatever it was, this unity or harmony or synergetic relationship was not on the surface. The identification was in what in Sanskrit is called the bhava, the mood, the tone, the affect, an outlook on or approach to life, to others, to disciples, to the sense objects. In short, to the world. Probably it should be called the oneness of their realization. In Swami Prabhupada's eyes and face, one very often saw the combination of deep inward joy and the shedding of light from that joy, like a beam, on everything encountered, which one sees in most of the photographs of Swami Brahmananda. It is apparent, too, in photographs of Prabhupada. I have written of Swami's face and the mobility of his features, the ease with which they model the mood, and how rapidly they could change. His eyes were of a type seen in a number of Bengalis, with their complex racial origins, almost almond eyes, far eastern in the outer corner fold of the upper eyelid. It must have heightened the air of inscrutability already conveyed by his inwardness and his silence. As he aged, the wrinkles came and the gray showed in his hair, but it had little effect on his beauty. Swami's lectures and classes, letters, conversations, and instructions are filled with expressions such as Maharaj used to say, or you know Maharaj used to, and so, or I will refer it to Maharaj, as in the letter that he wrote to me in 1970. Quote, about another assistant to give me a little relief, I have completely surrendered myself to the Lord. Do not depend upon a man, no man. It is the Lord's work and he will see to it. As long as any breath is left in me, I shall try only to be the instrument, or rather, the witness to his work. Maharaj taught me, the Lord does his own preaching, be the witness. I try to be that, and I am myself surprised to witness how he is preaching his word. His will be done. Let not any trace of ego, such as I am the teacher, be left in us. Thus only we can make our lives blessed. When he was about to go off to India, a daughter, in quotes, asked him how he could think of leaving all of us to our own resources. After all, what if someone got into a crisis? Like, say, going into samadhi. Swami laughed too, and he looked around the room at our faces and said, well, if you get into samadhi, you won't need me anyway. Why, I have thrown you all at the feet of Sri Maharaj. He will look after everything. He called Swami Brahmananda a fountain of love and an ocean of mercy. A choice story concerns the era in the early 1930s, probably when Swami had decided to learn to drive a car. He did learn, and he drove for quite some time, but he confessed that once, while he was driving somewhere alone on a slippery, unpaved road, the car ran off the road and the brakes proved useless. So he folded his legs under him on the seat, crying, all right, Maharaj, you take over. After careening a while along the shoulder of the road, the automobile came to rest just as it approached a tree. Many of us felt that Maharaj had indeed taken over his whole body, thought and will long ago. I never cared to record his many utterances and stories about his teacher. Who would? You were spellbound in the mood generated by his recounting of them. One story made it into my notebook. I'll give that. Swami Brahmananda, as we know, always advised, speak the truth, but never a harsh truth. He was so conscientious about the truth himself, Swami said, that even in seemingly inconsequential matters, he would try never to deviate from it. Once a person passing through his room on an errand happened to ask him, has the milkman brought the milk yet, Maharaj? Yes, replied the Swami, and then added, so I have heard. Maharaj could be naughty too and play practical jokes, some of which are now famous. Swami would confide to the monks now and then some of his naughtier tricks, and like so much about Maharaj, they were subtle. Swami Prabhupada never let up his challenge to one and all to think constantly of the Lord. How does one do this without going crazy? As Christopher Isherwood has well explained in his introduction to the book Religion in Practice, a published collection of Swami's discourses, this becomes possible, even easy, when we have had contact with a life in which God is obviously embodied. For Swami, so identified was his guru with God, that when he thought of the former, which was the natural and insistent bent of his mind, remembrance of God was accomplished. Every time you think of the Lord, he told us, he knows about it, and so do his saints. Every time you think of him, he nods at you. But he does not always let you know that he is nodding at you, otherwise you'd go crazy. Like a beggar who inherits $100,000. Each of us has his or her own heroes. I used to feel embarrassed when comparisons between the Swamis Vivekananda and Brahmananda were brought up in Swami Prabhupada's presence, and I thought it was unfortunate. It was like baiting someone, albeit unconsciously. Swami had not seen Swamiji. Not only had he seen Maharaj, he had lived with him, soaked up his teachings and his enthusiasms, built his life around him, made him his all in all. What could he be expected to say? Occasionally one heard that Swami Prabhupada did not acknowledge Swamiji as the chief disciple of the Master, having accorded that place of honor to Maharaj instead. But both in his speaking and his writing, Swami was careful to make the distinction between disciple and child, that Maharaj was Sri Ramakrishna's own spiritual child, had been owned in all the accounts. The Master's vision of Rock Hall, his utterances about the boy, the love and reverence in which Maharaj was held by the other disciples, all attested to this. Swami told us during our group reading in the library of the book Lila Prasanga, The Great Master, that Swami Sharadananda, the author, had withheld something. He had desisted from giving the material he had at first intended to write on Swami Brahmananda, because the latter was living at the time the book needed to be published. Otherwise, the proportion of the report given to the two would have been different. Swami referred to Naran, to Swamiji, as the apostle, the message bearer, the great active whose mission it was to bring Ramakrishna's thought and life to the rest of the world. So far as this role on the world scene was concerned, no one could be compared to Swamiji. Swami was a thorough student and interpreter of Swamiji's works. But when the photos had been framed for the shrine in Hollywood and the library at Chabuco, he had placed the two brother disciples side by side as equals. He felt that India had lionized Vivekananda because of his success in the West and the implications his mission had for the political history of the country. Therefore, in India, the authorities had everywhere enshrined the Big Three for public veneration, and others coming west had followed suit. For Swami, those were not necessarily the greatest spiritual attributes. While all that external activity was going on, necessary as it might be, great power, power for life-changing, for uplifting the atmosphere and thought current of those round about, was dwelling and developing in Maharaj, all hidden from public notice. He would cite the incidents of Swamiji's touching the latter's feet after returning from abroad, and his remarking to Sharat Chandra Chakravarti about Maharaj's spiritual elevation and power. So Swami would equate them, the twin stars of equal brilliance, offspring of the father and the mother. Swami was aware that this view had its detractors. When this was brought to his attention, it would move him to command silence with a classic one-liner. Quote, "Anyone who makes the distinction between Swamiji and Maharaj has not understood either Maharaj or Swamiji." After the Vivekananda sculpture was installed at the heart of the monastery at Tribhuvan, he turned to me and said, "Well, at least they can't say I put up Maharaj." It was a point of view all of a piece with his own spiritual existence. One might argue with it, one never wanted to argue it with him. Quite naturally, he felt closest to the other disciples of Swami Brahmananda in America. It was they whom we saw as frequent visitors. To see and hear these children of Maharaj, grown men and serious swamis, playing and laughing together was a treat for us. And it helped us to understand the divine joy in which, as spiritual beings, they were born. Someone in India, I have forgotten now who, told me that Swami Prabhupada was Maharaj's favorite child. It accounts for much. With these observations, I should like to couple what Swami Prabhupada wrote to me in 1958 when I had returned to Northern California. Quote, "I am glad to learn that you are getting better acquainted with Swami Shraddhananda, who was then assistant minister of the Vedanta Society of Northern California, recently arrived. You will be greatly benefited by a close association with him. Remember, whatever outer coating the Swamis may put on, inside they are all bhaktas. It reminds me what Swami Turiyananda once said. A young disciple had remarked to him, 'Swami, I wish I could read your mind.' And the Swami replied, 'You may read many thoughts that may be there, but if you go deeper, there is no other thought but Ramakrishna.'" And thus must we all mold our lives, so that deep inside there may not be any thought other than that of Ramakrishna. End of quote. Yet, among all the Swamis whose association I have been privileged to have, it was Swami Prabhupada who most emphasized the supremacy of the Guru in spiritual life. At one of the sessions at his feet, someone had asked, "Sri Ramakrishna says, 'Always test your guru thoroughly.' But then again, there's the old saying, 'Though my guru visits the tavern, still he is my all in all.' Is there not a contradiction here?" The first, Swami had replied, applies before you accept him, that is, testing the guru. The second, afterward. So it had been with him. He told us that his own younger brother, though not a monk, had received the grace of Maharaj to the extent of experiencing samadhi. It was, I believe, the time we were seated one evening in the living room of the greenhouse after class, and Swami was in one of those affectionate and confiding moods, that he shared the following treasure from his experience. Some may find it puzzling or shocking. I was not surprised, because I'd been led to suspect it already. "Do you know," he asked, "who is manifest very much?" "Three: Mother, Swamiji, and Maharaj." "Thakur, Ramakrishna?" "I don't know. But these three are very much manifest whenever anyone takes the name of Sri Ramakrishna." End of quote. I wondered if it was not like Christians who knock on the doors of the saints and apply through them. Then there was the day, it may be in 1955 or so, when some of us were transfixed with awe as he told us, "Through his grace, the world of Thakur, Mother, Swamiji, and Maharaj has become more real to me than this one."